Good to see you this morning. All right, we're continuing our series called Kingdom Manifesto. And we're just so friendly this morning. Continuing the series called Kingdom Manifesto, and it's really part of our vision for the year where we're just immersing ourselves constantly in the stories of Jesus and allowing the stories of Jesus to change our life. And what we're seeing week after week is you cannot encounter Jesus without him changing your life. And so we're talking about Jesus, and man, do I have a good story for you this morning. If you've got your Bibles, open up to Matthew chapter 5, verse 13. And as you're turning there, let me just confess to you this morning that I have a problem with public restrooms. Now, I'm not typically obsessive compulsive about anything. Just take a look at my car. But when it comes to public restrooms, like, my goal is to get in and out without touching anything. I just don't want to. I love bathrooms that have sensors on everything. They've got a sensor on the toilet. They've got a sensor on the wash area. They've got those little foot pedals to open the door so you don't have to touch anything. And so my job as a dad in so many respects is to teach my kids. And I've got three little kids, and if you remember having little kids in the house, taking them to a public restroom, they touch everything. And so if you hear me take, like, Bear into the restroom, six-year-old Bear, you'll hear a whole lot of, like, oh, don't touch that. Oh, don't step in that. Oh, don't, oh, gosh. Now, if you know, especially for guys, toilets, what do you use to flush the toilet? Your foot, always your foot. You never use your hand. As if you use your hand, you just put your hand where I put my foot, which was on the ground next to the toilet, and it's disgusting. And so I try to get the kids in and out with this, with touching as little as humanly possible. Now, here's why I tell you this, is that I think that many Christians in the U.S. view the world like I view public restrooms. How do I get in and out with touching as little as possible? How do I get in and out with being contaminated as little as possible? How do I follow Jesus and not be contaminated by culture? And so we read things like the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15:33, bad company corrupts good character, which is true. And so it's easy to feel this tension in life. How do I live in the world but not be of the world? And so there's this subtle message that's communicated sometimes about how we're corruptible, that we're like a sponge that just soaks up everything around us. And so it's easy to feel like we've got to distance ourselves from those that don't have similar values or don't live similar lifestyles. But there's only one problem with this kind of mentality, and that's Jesus. Jesus was always with the wrong people, and all the people he shouldn't talk to, he was talking to. All the places he shouldn't go, he was going. And everywhere he wasn't supposed to be, that's where Jesus was. And what we're going to see this morning is that how we engage the world around us goes to the very identity of who we are as followers of Jesus. And so if you've got your Bibles, Matthew chapter 5, verse 13, it says this. It says, we are the salt of the earth. You are the salt of the earth. But if salt loses its saltiness, it's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the salt of the earth. Now, just a little bit of context, that the people that Jesus was talking to, this was in Israel, which is a desert climate. There was no refrigeration. There was no ice. There was no airtight packaging. So when you think about salt in the ancient Near Eastern culture, salt was considered a necessity for life. The salt was what kept things from going bad. It kept food from spoiling. It was a preservative. It was a purifier. It added taste. It cleansed wounds. It killed germs. It promoted healing. All of these different things. And so Jesus is saying that if you follow me, remember this statement is coming right after the Beatitudes, that if you live these things out, then that's what your presence does in the world. All these things that salt does that you're so familiar with, the purifier and adding taste and promoting healing, that's what you do in this culture as you follow after me. He says, you are the salt of the earth. And then he gives another identity statement to his disciples. He says, you are the light of the world. You're the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. goes on to say, a city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand and it gives light to everyone in the house. And in the same way, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds. And let's say that last line together. They may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. That they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. They may see the way that you live and glorify Father. They see the way that you live and immediately understand and know what God is like. They see you, and the direct correlation is they see what God is like. But what does it look like to be the light of the world? If we're the salt of the earth, then we will be the light of the world, for salt will be light. But what does that look like in our lives? Let me share a story with you this morning that I think gives us a crystal clear picture of what it looks like and means for us to be the light of the world. In your Bibles, go ahead and flip over to John chapter 8. If you don't have your Bibles, it'll be on the screen behind me. John chapter 8, and I would love for us all to read this out loud together. John chapter 8, verse 12, 1, 2, 3. When Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Now, this is a huge statement that Jesus is making here, but what I want to point us to is the context in which Jesus spoke this statement. It comes right on the heels of an encounter that he had with a group of people, and I want to take us there. At chapter 8, verse 12, or chapter 8, verse 2, it says, at dawn he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. That was the posture of a teacher. He sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. Say with me, act of adultery. Now, if you're following the law, then you understand this woman is guilty. And so if you're taking notes, you can write this in, that the law reveals our guilt. The law reveals our guilt. Now, let's unpack this a little bit, because somehow a Pharisee or two, these very righteous, pure, legalistic men had found themselves in the bedroom of a man and a woman. And so they're there, and just nod at me if I don't need to get into the Greek of what's going on here. Like, we understand. She is caught in the act of adultery. We understand, right? We can move on from here. Caught in the act. Pharisees in that day felt like it was their job to purify Israel. They believed that Israel was under Roman occupation because Israel had deserted their God. They had been unfaithful to following their God. And so Pharisees get a hard time so oftentimes because they're so legalistic, but because they were legalistic because they wanted to purify Israel. They wanted everybody to clean up their act. So here they are in the bedroom of this man and this woman. They grab this woman. Here we see, for some reason, the man isn't held accountable. But they take this woman who is guilty. She is wrong. She's sinful. But they drag her out after being caught in the act of adultery. So it's likely, we don't know for sure, but probably she's not wearing a whole lot. And maybe she grabbed a sheet on the way out or something like that. But she's in public humiliation beyond description. And I would say without a shadow of a doubt that this has got to be this woman's darkest, most shame-filled, humiliating moment of her life. And she's there with her life hanging in the balance. And the Pharisees say, should we stone her like the law says? Now, just in case you're new to the scriptures, when they say, should we stone her, they're not saying, should we give her marijuana? And just so we know, what they're asking is, should we take this woman to the edge of a cliff, push her off so she breaks her legs and can't run away, and take stones and throw it at her head and chest until she dies? That's the question that they're asking Jesus. Should we stone her like the law says? And then in verse 5, put that up if you would, Ronnie. Verse 5, it says, in the law. Would you say that? In the law. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. Now, what do you say, Jesus? And so they're asking him. Verse 6 says, they were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. They wanted to catch Jesus and trap him. Now, what they're saying is true, that in the law of Moses, if you get caught in adultery, you get the death penalty. So what they're saying is true, and they're saying, Jesus, what do you have to say about this? What are your thoughts about this? And they're not asking because they're curious. They're trying to trap him. They hate Jesus. They want to kill Jesus. They want to discredit Jesus in front of the people. But what I want you to see here is that Jesus very easily could have judged this woman. She was wrong. He could have condemned her. That was her punishment. See, the law reveals our guilt, but the second thing, if you're taking notes, is that Jesus reveals God's grace. The law reveals our guilt, but Jesus reveals God's grace. And we see this in Jesus in verse 6. They're trying to trick him and trap him. These guys, now I'm not very theatrical, so I have a hard time really communicating this, but these guys are coming with guns blazing. They hate Jesus. They're trying to trick him. They're trying to trap him. There is a woman there standing in the midst. They're ready to condemn her, ready to sentence her to death. And here they are. They're humiliating this woman, trying to trick Jesus. And they're asking Jesus, what should we do? Highly contentious situation. High conflict situation. And Jesus' response in this massively conflicting situation is this. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. Jesus, what do you have to say about this? And here he is, and he just draws in the sand with his finger. Now, I don't know what you do when you're in a high conflict situation. It's probably not to draw in the sand with your finger, right? And so here's Jesus, and it's interesting because what psychologists tell us is that one way to diffuse a high conflict situation is to do something unpredictable. In fact, Sarah and I know of a guy that lives in downtown Philadelphia in a high gang area, and he moved there on purpose because he wanted to be Jesus in that neighborhood and see restoration and reconciliation in these high gang, high crime areas. And his method for reconciliation, anytime there's gang violence or shooting, he runs outside and gets in the middle of it and starts to juggle. That's his whole method. I just start juggling, and it throws everybody. Nobody wants to throw a punch at a juggler, right? So he's out there, and so here Jesus is. He's on his knee, and he's drawing with his finger. And now, what did he write? And the truth is, we don't know for sure what he wrote, but a lot of scholars believe, and there's some evidence towards this, that he was writing down the sins of these guys that were accusing this woman, like John, I know the way you looked at that lady last week. Or Hank, I know about that secret stash of Twinkies that you're keeping away from your wife. And the reason that a lot of people think that he was writing this is there's two words that are translated in the Greek language to write down. One word is the Greek word graphen, and that just means to write down. But the other Greek word is katagraphen, and it means to write down a record against. And that's the Greek word that's used here in this text. And so maybe he's writing down a record of sins that these men who are accusing this woman. Verse 7 says, when they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and he said to them, if any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone against her. Now, again, in the Greek language, the word translated without sin, it just doesn't mean to not sin. It means to never have wanted to sin. And so Jesus isn't focusing just on the outward behavior. He's focusing also on the inward heart. Now, hey, any of you that have never sinned and never have actually wanted to sin before, go ahead and pick up a rock and you can throw the first stone. What's interesting about this is that Jesus is going after something that's really, really important. That these judgmental, hypocritical guys have the same problem that all of us have at some point, and that it's very easy to identify the sins of other people without identifying the sins that are lurking in our own heart. It's so easy to pick other people apart and say, well, look at her, or look at him, or I can't believe that he does that, without noticing our own sinfulness in our own lives. And Jesus says, if you're without sin, yeah, go ahead and throw the first stone. Then in verse 8, again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground, so he's back to drawing in the sand. And what's interesting to me is that this thing, if any of you is without sin, let him be, that's all he says in this entire discourse. They're threatening. They're trying to catch him. This woman's life is hanging in the balance of what Jesus has to say. And all he has to say is, if you're without sin, you can throw the first stone. And he stoops down and writes again. And then verse 9, it says, at this, those who heard began to go away one at a time. The older one first, until only Jesus was left, with the woman still standing there. So Jesus is there with this woman, maybe with just a sheet, and she'd been caught in adultery, and it's just the two of them standing there. And in verse 10, it says Jesus straightened up and asked her, maybe this is the first time that he sees her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" And broken and shamed and humiliated, the darkest moment of her life, she says, "No one, sir." And Jesus looked at this broken woman and spoke the most grace-filled, loving words in the history of the world, and he says, "Then neither do I condemn you." Let me just pause there for a moment and say that there's somebody that probably walked in today with a little bit of darkness hanging over their life, a little bit of shame, a little bit of agony over something that you did. And I just want to make this really clear, that when you're standing alone with Jesus, and when he looks at you, it's not condemnation that he gives you, but it's always his grace. Now help me out. Was this woman guilty? Yes or no? Yeah. Well, did she deserve punishment according to the law of Moses? Yeah. She deserved it, but Jesus didn't give it. She deserved this, but he did not give it to her. This happened to me several years ago. I was in college, and I had a date to a formal event at our college, and I wanted to make a good impression, so I asked my dad if I could drive his 1967 Corvette. And there's a picture of it right there, and you just got to know a couple things about this car. It's got over 450 horsepower, and we're talking about old horsepower, not new horsepower. This is the kind of horsepower that when you drive by another car, it sets the alarm off. It's got 14-inch tires, no manual, it's manual steering, so it's like you just feel strong driving this thing. And so the amazing thing to me is I asked if I could drive it. He said yes, but I didn't know how to drive a standard. And so he still said yes. He gave me about a 15-minute tutorial in the parking lot and said, "Have fun." And so I take my date, and then we go dancing, and I drive the car back, and I'm cruising at like 100 miles an hour down the freeway, just having the time of my life. The top is off, and like I'm just loving life, and it starts to sprinkle a little bit. And I get off the freeway, and I'm turning onto Agora Road to get home, and I think I'm just going to have a little bit more fun before I pull into the driveway, and I goose it going around the corner, think I'm just going to fishtail it. And as soon as I hit the gas, the thing spins out of control. I'm spinning around in circles in my lane. I'm spinning in circles into the other lane, and I drive straight into a ditch in my dad's 1967 Corvette. And my life flashes before my eyes, and I think, what am I going to do? I'm dead. And so I think, okay, what do? I could lie. I could just say, you know, somebody cut me off, and I had to swerve really quick. And I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. And so I drive the car home, and I go straight up to my dad and say, "Dad, this is what happened." And he looks at me, and I'll never forget this. He said, "Don't worry about it. It's just a car." Can you believe that? "Don't worry about it. It's just a car." See, what I want you to see here is I haven't driven it since then, just by the way. That's another story. But I was guilty. I was incredibly guilty. I drove his 1967 Corvette into a ditch. I was guilty. And you're guilty. See, we're all guilty in the eyes of a perfect and holy God. See, the law reveals our guilt. But Jesus reveals God's grace. And he looks at this broken woman who's shamed by every human being within miles away. And Jesus drives her condemners away and says, "Where are they now? Neither do I condemn you." And then what does he say next? Does he say, okay, now that you're forgiven, you just try your best not to do this anymore? In fact, you know, I'm Jesus, and so I know your past, and I know your dad abandoned you, and you've been looking to men to fill that void for a long time. You've been looking for love in the wrong places, and I know you're going to struggle with this some more, but just try not to have it. Just try not to commit adultery. Try not to sleep with married men. And does he say that? Does he say, just try your best to avoid it? He doesn't do that. What does he do with this woman? The same thing I believe that he does with every single one of us. And if you're taking notes, the law reveals our guilt. Jesus reveals God's grace, and he leads us to freedom. It's not don't try to deal with this anymore. It's not try it. No, just do your best. He leads us to freedom. In verse 11, he says, neither do I condemn you. Go now and leave your life of sin. That there's this sense of urgency to this. Go now, not later, that you can be free right now. And I know you came in here with shame and all the condemnation from other people, and you're experiencing hurt and the self-hatred of all of this, but there's hope. Leave this now and experience freedom. You don't have to live there anymore. And so this woman leaves, and I want you to catch this, because every story that we see with Jesus, we saw it last week, we saw it the week before that, that this woman, she leaves this encounter with Jesus, not condemned, which is what all the other religious leaders wanted to do to her. She left this encounter with Jesus, not hopeless, like she was feeling before this encounter with Jesus. She left this encounter with Jesus transformed. She met Jesus, she encountered Jesus, and it changed her life. See, the law reveals our guilt, Jesus reveals God's grace, and always leads us to freedom. In the very next verse, it says, when Jesus spoke again to the people, he said, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, because they'll have the light of life. Now, don't miss this. Jesus says that he is the light of the world. And people that encounter Jesus experience his grace and his freedom. Jesus says he's the light of the world, and he guided this woman away from condemnation and towards freedom. Jesus says he's the light of the world, and he points people to what God the Father is like. And it's shocking that the perfect and holy God does not throw stones, but he leads us to freedom. And what's amazing about this whole story, Jesus says, I'm the light of the world. This is what it looks like. But then he looks at us. He says, you are the light of the world. You are the light, which means that however we live should reveal what God is like to the world. That however we live should not lead people to condemnation and tell people what a mess they're in. Instead, lead them to freedom. Not highlighting failures, but leading to freedom. Now catch this. Let me bring it back to the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 5, verse 14. When Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth and you are the light of the world, the emphasis in the Greek is on you. That you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. In other words, coming on the heels of the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit, he's saying basically, you, the spiritually bankrupt, the meek, the insignificant in the eyes of the world, the righteous, starved rabble that has responded to my invitation. You, not the Pharisees, not the super intellectual religious leaders, not the Roman government leaders, not the wealthy landowners, not the politically connected, not any of those that other people would assume are crucial to the world. It's not them, it's you that are the salt of the earth and the light of the world. And as the salt of the earth, and as the light of the world, that when you live in this way, it points people to what God is like. That this is who you are as followers of Jesus. That Jesus is our example in everything. And I'm reminded of 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21, that says, for God called you to do good, even if it means suffering, just as Christ suffered for you. He is your example, and you must follow in his steps. 1 John 2:6 says that whoever lives in him must walk as Jesus walked. That in everything in our life, that we're to live like Jesus. I just wonder what would happen if in every area of our life, if we just thought, is that the way Jesus would do it? What would that change about our life? Is that how Jesus would do it? Jesus says, you're the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. And what that means is that when we live like he is calling us to live, reflecting the values of his kingdom, it points people to what God the Father is like. Let's be like Jesus. Would you bow your heads and close your eyes with me?